My guest today is Lulu Raghavan, Vice President APAC at Landor. Lulu is a revered global leader and an authority in brand transformation. With over two decades of brand management expertise, she's respected for her thought leadership, sought after by clients and industry peers alike. A prolific speaker, Lulu graces international brand and design conferences, anchoring Bloomberg UDV's Beyond Logo and serving on the Cannes Lions Design Jury. Honored with Impact's Top 50 Women in Media, Marketing and Advertising and Campaign India's Women Leading Change of the Year Award, Lulu champions design's power for commercial and social impact. Committed to mentorship and education, she actively guides young professionals and shares her expertise through her newsletter, Ideas to Play With. Such an exciting conversation I'm looking forward to. And thank you very much, Lulu, and welcome to Atlanta Diaries.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your show, Enma.
Thank you. And on a lighter note, I do have to share with you that my two boys are both in the creative field. One's a film and media student and the other's an industrial designer. And when I told the younger one that I'm meeting you today, he was very excited. So you have a young professional at home who follows you.
Oh my gosh, that is the biggest honor. More exciting than anything else. Thank you. Say hello to him. And if there's anything I could do to help him or have a chat with him, I'm happy to.
I'll definitely let him know and maybe ask him to connect with you on LinkedIn if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So moving on, Lulu, two decades, three continents, four offices and 10 bosses. A journey that probably millennials and Gen Z might find very uncommon. What factors do you believe enable this commitment and diverse professional experience? Love to start with this thought.
You know, your question takes me back 23 years to my first day at Landor in San Francisco. We had this fantastic office at 1001 Front Street overlooking the bay. And on my first day, Enma, I had orientation on the third floor. There was this grand conference room where everyone was gathering and you had this beautiful view. And I felt awed. I fell in love with Landor from the get-go. And I think being in love with the company, being in love with the work that I do has been that secret sauce to keep me motivated, to keep me going. And I've been lucky because I think the love has been reciprocal. I've had opportunities for growth. I've had the opportunity to serve Landor in many different offices in the world, in many different continents, with many, many different groups of people. So at this point, I'm probably drinking the Kool-Aid, but it started from day one.
I can imagine. And I can sense that passion and love for the organization. And I guess that's the only way it's possible to hang in there for those many years.
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes my mom would say, enough of Landor now. You need to pay attention to your kids. It's almost like Landor is your most important kid. So I think my husband was definitely very supportive. It wasn't like my mother was not supportive, but I think she felt that, you know, you need to balance things.
Interesting that you bring your mom, because she was the one who saw that inclination towards brand when you were the one who was looking at banking and consulting sector. So tell us, how did you land this job?
Yeah. But it's actually an interesting story. And you grew up in India, so you know, growing up in India, if you did anything other than maths and science, you were seen as an idiot. And I did maths and science, but you know, while I was getting good grades, I wasn't completely in love with the subjects. And when I went to undergrad at Davidson in North Carolina, I discovered a love for economics. This was 1997. India was just starting to boom at that point in time. So rather than stay on in the US, I saw opportunities in India. My natural choices were consulting and banking. And so hesitatingly, I applied to these firms like McKinsey, Anderson Consulting, and I went for interviews. I quickly realized that just an undergrad degree is not enough for these firms because they have MBAs who are highly qualified and they can hire them. And so when I was in this period of thinking what I was going to do, I met a friend of my mother's who was helping her with her organization, Dignity Foundation. His name is Shumit Roy. He is an ad industry veteran. I had a conversation with him, very exploratory, said that I've come back to India. I'm thinking about banking and consulting. He asked me about my passions and interests. And, you know, halfway through the conversation, he just said, stop. And I was taken aback. And he said, Lulu, I have a very fundamental question for you. Do you want to be this small fish in a very big pond? Or might you be interested in being a very big fish in a small pond? It took me a while to understand what he was saying. I was, you know, barely 21, 22 years old. And when I understood what he was saying, my takeaway was, okay, I need to find an industry which is not a rat race. And that's when he said, have you ever thought of advertising and marketing? He got me so excited about it. And he said, you know, my friend Sridhar has just started Ogilvy Consulting at Ogilvy. And I think it'll be perfect for a person like you because brand consulting needs left brain skills and right brain skills. You're very passionate about everything that you've done, and I want you to give it a shot. So I had an interview with Sridhar, R. Sridhar, who is considered the father of direct marketing in India. And he was very excited that he could have a flunky who had just come out of college and wanted to be dedicated to him. It was the height of Ogilvy's success. And we were in Mumbai in the Churchgate office. You know, Ogilvy was absolutely killing it at the awards. I got to be with Sridhar to observe him, assist him on some of his assignments on brands. Sridhar had the most enviable collection of brand books. He subscribed to the Harvard Business Review. So half my day, I would just be crawled up on the sofa in his office, absorbing, just reading all of these brand books, watching him. And I got to know a lot of people in those days who are all heads of many agencies now. You know, we were this group of friends who went out together, and it was just such a great foundation. And so at Ogilvy, I fell in love with brand. Sridhar, my boss, then told me that he always felt insecure that he didn't have an MBA degree as a consultant. And so he said, I would recommend you go to business school in India. So, you know, I sat for those exams, thought I would easily get into IIM, but clearly it required much more prep. But I did get into SP Jain Institute of Management and Research in Andheri in Mumbai. And just when I was graduating from SP Jain, this dot-com explosion was happening in India. And believe it or not, Mahindra had automartindia.com, which Anand Mahindra was investing in, and I had seen brand as my thing. So I had a brief stint at Mahindra, but then my boyfriend in the US, then husband now, was in San Francisco. He proposed to me. So I left Mahindra after 3 months, moved to the US. And by then, because I had been at Ogilvy, I was in that whole circuit of advertising, marketing, branding, etc. And so in San Francisco, actually somebody who my husband knew somebody at this firm called Landor, which was part of Young and Rubicam in those days. I researched Landor, and there was a job in naming. And they loved the fact that I had so many languages on my resume. And then in January 22nd, actually, I started at Landor in San Francisco.
And what really inspired you to speak all these languages?
I think I got it from my dad. He can speak 7 Indian languages. When I was younger, I did Sanskrit and I did very well in it. I didn't start Hindi till I was in the 7th standard, but I picked it up fairly decently. Not great at it, but enough to do my 10th grade exams. They're just a plethora of choices when you do liberal arts undergrad. And somehow I had this desire to do a foreign language. So out of my 4 credits, 2 were French for 2 years. And the way our professor taught us, it was only French in class. So it was a very steep learning curve. I almost gave up, but somebody advised me to just write those verbs every day, like 100 times a day. And then you won't believe it. After about 4 months, I started getting it and I started zooming and doing really well. So much so that after finishing 2 years, I got into the Davidson in Tour in France program for 6 months. So we spent a month in Paris and then lived with a French family for 5 months in Tour. And then I did French film and French history. So I could have almost done French as a major. And then in that period when I was in California and I was getting my H-1 visa, I had 6 months. One day when I went to the laundromat in our neighborhood, because, you know, we were a young couple, we didn't have a washing machine and all of that stuff, people would just speak to me in Spanish. They just thought I was Mexican. And I said, oh my God, I would love to speak to them back in Spanish. So I taught myself Spanish. That French grounding, I think, allowed me to do Spanish. And, you know, even now, especially French, when I speak to, you know, native speakers, they always say my accent is so good and how did I manage it? And that motivates me and it makes me feel like, okay, I need to fully get back into another language. And there's just a level of connect that you have with people when you can speak their language is incredible. And I think both French and Spanish have helped me, you know, in good stead.
That's beautiful. Lulu, shifting gears a little bit, love to talk about your leadership journey now. When did you really know that leadership was your calling? Because not everyone wants to get into leadership today.
My dad worked in the corporate world. And so even when I was 13 or 14, when people would ask me, what do you want to be? I would say CEO. I had no idea what that meant, but that's what I said. In school, being a prefect, housewife captain, all of that helped because I knew that I could lead people. I think when I came back to India, started establishing Landor in India, when we would do branding programs, I could see that I had command over a large room of senior clients. In fact, when we used to do workshops and I would, you know, sometimes tell people to stop talking and be focused, and these are very, very senior people, or just rally everyone together. Some of our clients will say, wow, you're really good at it. You should be a tour guide or something like that. And so I would say it was only about midway through my career when I felt the calling of leadership, or understanding that, hey, now people are watching me and I need to mold and shape myself a lot more.
That's interesting. Did you raise your hand to get into that leadership role, or do you think you were sort of identified for it?
I was the EA to our CEO, and I know he knew my skills, he knew my potential. So I'm pretty sure I was identified as someone who had a lot of potential. In fact, even Enma, when I started at Landor, 2 weeks after I joined, we had our biggest layoffs ever. It was the Silicon Valley crash. This was 2001, and there were about 30 people being let go. And I was pretty sure I was going to be on the list, but the gentleman who hired me, Alton Wright, had actually fought to save me because he thought that I had some great potential and was a different kind of talent for Landor. But it was only this serendipitous opportunity of my husband and I returning to India and me having this opportunity to establish Landor in India that brought out so much of that. So I had the opportunity and then I molded myself.
And made the best use of it.
Yeah.
So talk to us about your philosophy and how did it influence your leadership style?
Initially, it was just me and 5 others. I had set up Landor in India. So it was a very, very small team. And so you just very organically did things. It was me almost like day one, day zero, doing everything from making my own chai to doing my own Xeroxing and travel arrangements to client presentations. I always had that dignity of labor, no matter what job I could do it. You know, I think probably it's a result of my US undergrad and then my work in the US. It's just a very, very different culture. Also, Davidson, we have the honor code, which means that you can take your exams in your dorm room or anywhere. That sense of integrity is instilled in you from that early age. So I just inherently trusted people to get things done. So I was very warm, empathetic as an approach. And therefore that laissez-faire attitude came from, you know what's best for the company. Now you make that decision rather than command and control. Of course, there were standards. I had to micromanage at times if the standards were not right. But in general, I believed in giving people the freedom to do things, to allow them to take their own initiative and to be accountable and responsible. And actually, that's also translated into my parenting style. And so even with my kids, I'm not a tiger mom who chases them. I always believe that they know what's right to do. Of course, there are times where I directionally will fix, but I'm much more laissez-faire and allow the other person to get on with it rather than be very authoritative or dictatorial. Now, I know sometimes that can swing to being too permissive, and some people take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And so striking the balance and being assertive and knowing who is not going to thrive in a laissez-faire environment is important.
How did you then strike your balance? Because it's a cultural thing, right? You cannot completely make it like an honor system in India unless you were able to create that culture at Landor.
I think I have, absolutely. That's part of our success here as well, and globally as well. I think a lot of our clients will say the degree of professionalism that Landor brings to the table is very, very, very high, which means the responsiveness, the respect, the way we conduct ourselves with our clients, the trust, the accountability. If you say you'll get it done by six, then you need to get it done by six, or you send an email and say it's going to be late. That communication is very high, all of that. It's harder now, I have to say, because the scale is a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, before it was just 20, 25 people. Now we have almost 200 people. We still have only 2 days a week compulsory work from the studios. But even then, nobody's really checking attendance. And we trust people to show up twice a week. And just because a few people won't follow, you shouldn't punish everybody by having a dictatorial system. So I think it is still being very open, flexible, nurturing, but keeping an eye on anyone who's taking too much advantage of it and having a conversation with them, maybe even weeding them out if it's not the right fit.
Interesting. It's great to get this insight that often people say follow the well-done approach and, you know, just applaud the ones who are doing a good job. But what you're saying is that also weed out the ones who are not doing a good job.
It's hard. And, you know, there is a backlash around it as well. But we are a high-performance culture. And we're also a culture of good people. And if they're just people who are toxic, who are negative, that could also be a reason where we might gently persuade someone to leave. For me, that cultural fit, personality, drive is so much more important than the skills per se.
So I want to sort of double click on this a little bit, Lulu. So you, on one hand, you did say that you're a high performance culture, right? But I also totally understand when you said toxicity is not something which is acceptable. So what would you choose over the other?
So for example, there are people in our system who are amazing with clients, but not so good with internal teams. Client centricity can't come at the cost of the team being unhappy. So there's a lot of coaching and conversation for those people. Toxicity is not accepted. So if somebody is being negative, somebody is not being a team player, they definitely are shown the door or encouraged to leave. On the other hand, nice people do survive. They survive everywhere. Of course, we don't tolerate a performance below a certain level. They may not be the highest performer. They may be average or above average, but they will stick around because their positive energy, their commitment, their drive to get it done. You need all sorts of people on a team. It can't just be these super smart, high achievers who are all going to kill each other. You need, you need people who are just genuinely good people. They may not be the sharpest tools, you know, in our toolbox, but they have a role to play as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Share with us one of your toughest decisions as a leader.
Gosh, quite a lot of those. I'd have to say I found letting people go hard, whether it's a performance issue, whether we actually hired incorrectly. They were excited, but we didn't assess their ability and therefore we brought them on. You know, when you bring someone on, you have a responsibility to make them a part of the family. This is what Simon Sinek says. And so one of my biggest learnings is in the rush of growth, when everything's so busy, you're less disciplined about finding the exact right person, because you just want somebody who's, you know, has the right experience, and then you bring people in and then you're like, oh my God, that was so wrong. So I think saying no to those people, or after 6 months letting them go, is hard. And then related to that, there have been two or three times in my career where, because of the performance, we'd overhired. And as a leader, you have to take responsibility for that, and you have to do it in the most human way possible. The first time I did it, I didn't have the level of empathy that I should have had. I didn't open my Rolodex the way I should have to say, you know what, we'll find you jobs elsewhere. And so I think for me, those decisions around letting people go have been the hardest, because I also have very strong relationships with people. And those are tough conversations. But over the years, I've learned that you have to have those conversations, both for individuals as well as for the health of the business. So now I embrace it. But I also am more cautious in hiring. So getting that part of the business model right is very critical.
You also spoke about, you know, the fact that leaders need to get out of the way. I would love you to narrate that story where your stupidity turned out to be a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, so the context of this, Enma, is that, you know, because I started the business in India, my name is so intrinsically linked. It's Landor, Lulu, Lulu, Landor in India. I've been trying to get past it and transcend it for the longest time. So when I'm in the room, naturally, clients will gravitate towards me. So not being in the room is an answer, because then other people can really flourish and thrive. And this was about 10 years ago. One of my client directors, a design director, and I were going to Delhi for a pitch. And it was extremely important because our new boss, we had moved from being part of EMEA, the European and Middle Eastern region, to being part of Asia, APAC. And our boss, who was based in Singapore, said, hey, you know, you guys need to start getting some consumer clients. So here was this big pitch in Delhi. December from Bombay, we reached the airport at 6 a.m. IndiGo flight was delayed by 4 hours. My colleagues and I were on the cafe coffee day, chit-chatting. Before we knew it, it was 8:45, and suddenly we heard our names on the loudspeaker. So we rushed. They pulled up an IndiGo car so that they could take us to the plane. And when we got to the plane and they asked me for my boarding pass, I couldn't find it. In that flustered state of rushing to catch the flight, I couldn't find the silly boarding pass, and they detained me. Can you imagine? They deplaned me. In those days, we had a BlackBerry, and I showed them my ticket on a BlackBerry. And they didn't even know how to exit me out of the airport. Police had to be called, because once you've checked in and stuff, you can't just cruise out of the airport. I was all planning for Delhi, December. I had boots, I had a blazer on, and I was sweating by 10 o'clock with my woolen socks and blazer. And I just wanted to get home. And in frustration, I told this flight attendant, I'm like, come on, I can't be the first idiot in the world who's done this. You guys have to have a precedent for this. And she looked at me with a straight face and said, no, ma'am, you are. I mean, I was literally the first idiot who's ever done this, apparently, where I lost the printed boarding pass. But the lesson there, so my colleagues, they were so scared. They were like, what do you mean you're not coming on the flight? But they went off, and Enma, they did so well because they were suddenly liberated. They knew they had to do it. I wasn't there. They flourished. They won the business. We went on to do extremely well with this client. And for the client director in particular, I feel like it was a coming of age moment where I don't think the client would have known the difference. But for her, she started believing in herself. And so I feel like biggest regret of my career is I've dominated the room too many times. And I just wish much earlier I had gotten out of the way so many more leaders could have grown faster. Because I think when the senior person is there, nobody else gets a chance. And so responsibility, especially in businesses like ours, it may not always be the case, is that you have to consciously give those opportunities for others on the team to be the big boss in the room.
So before we talk about the APAC role, Lulu, talk to us about how did this whole idea of thinking about your own brand come up, and considering that you're already pursuing your own career and your own, you know, very, very demanding journey.
Yeah, interestingly, by the way, this story is the start of my book, which I've just finished writing. It's going to be published by Bloomsbury. But again, as with my leadership, it was the most obvious thing, but I never even thought about personal branding until in 2015, an organization called Zmelt, they messaged me and they said, "Hey, Lulu, do you want to do a workshop on personal branding?" And I was thinking, "What? What do you mean by personal branding?" And I never say no to any of these opportunities. So I said, "Yeah, sure." And so my colleague, Ghazala, who was a senior strategist then, and I put some thoughts to it. So we both came up with this workshop format. It was supposed to be a 1-hour workshop starting at 3 o'clock. They said that 20 people had signed up, but nobody was there. I looked at Ghazala and I said, "Oh my God, this is like going to be the most embarrassing day of our lives, Ghazala." But then people started slowly coming in, and you won't believe it, Enma, by 3:10, they had to open the doors and there were 55 people. And that one thing led to another, and I must have done like 50 to 100 sessions. And I started my own process and framework, because as you do this, you know, your thought process deepens. And then I think 6 or 7 years later, when I was in one of the workshops and I was talking a lot about Googling yourself and your website being important, one guy asked me, like, "What's your website?" And I didn't have one. And I was like, "Oh my God, I can't be giving gyan without actually having it." So then I invested in building my own website, thinking about how I define myself, what's my X factor. Then I started the newsletter. I wanted it to be about some value that I bring to others. So the whole thesis is that I've done branding for so many years. I can create a commercial value for companies, social value for institutions, organizations. But what about personal legacy? I'd love to be able to help individuals craft their personal legacy, but I just don't have time for that. So I just give them a broad overview and say, "You've got to do the work." With friends, I've done a little bit of it, and friends have said, "Oh my gosh, the way you define me has really helped." But that's when the whole idea for the book happened. And then just writing about personal branding felt too limited. And so when I brainstormed, I finally developed the concept of career advice for younger women. So I've just submitted it to Bloomsbury. The placeholder title is "Go Further, Faster: The Things I Wish I Knew When I Was 21 Years Old When I Was Entering the World of Work." So the first part is a holistic approach to work. The second part of it is developing your personal brand. And then the third part of it is, how do you keep evolving yourself? And then there are some handy how-tos, how to ask for a raise, how to complain about somebody, you know, how to get on a board, all these little small things. But this whole personal branding thing, which was ignited by that one request by Zmelt to do a workshop, has just opened up a whole avenue. But then, you know, in this Google world, suddenly you're an expert. So everyone says it's an expert. And I have to cringe a bit, because I don't know if you've picked up on this, but it's slightly controversial. There are a lot of people who think that it's a bit of a crass approach, or self-promotion's not good. But then you have this other camp of Google and Facebook who have been promoting that women especially have to know why they're remarkable, why they're awesome, because if you don't promote yourself, nobody else will. So anyway, I think nobody can argue with the fact that if you build your reputation in a very intentional way, it's going to bring a lot of value to you. So that's the sum and substance of it.
Yeah. Actually, you know, Lulu, this again brings me to the topic of culture, right? And I think you and I can relate to that one thing. You know, when you're navigating, especially your move from India to the US, that's the biggest thing you change. You know, your mom tells you, "Okay, just take it easy, like don't overplay it," right? But the reality is that there's no choice but to learn to put yourself out there and therefore do it with authenticity and therefore the need for your brand.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I can't tell you, ever since I started being intentional about it, which is around 2015, 2016, using LinkedIn and Instagram and all of that, the opportunities that I've had have been tremendous. People that I've met, connections that I've had, it just gives me a joy in itself, I have to say.
Yeah. And I was also smiling when you were narrating the whole thing, because I went through this journey myself in the last 6 months. I have never, ever reflected so much on my brand the way I did in the last 6 months. It really gave me a chance to take, you know, that step back and think about my journey, think about my values. So yeah, it's a topic very close to my heart.
Nice. Yeah, no, I think more women have to do that. And men, of course. I keep saying personal branding is not about shouting on social media or even having a website, but having clarity about who you are and the value that you bring to others is the most important piece. And if you're self-aware and you show up intentionally at every moment, then you're building your personal brand. And that's the gift that keeps on giving.
You know, you've sort of literally grown with the organization. Having said that, did you face any, you know, gender discrimination otherwise with other stakeholders?
Never gender. I think I would say in the US, never also being Indian. But when I was in the UK, I have to say, and maybe this was my own insecurities, I was in London, in the London office in 2006. That was probably the lowest point of my career. I just felt like an imposter. I just felt that I didn't belong for some reason, even though I had this amazing 7 years in the US. You know, culturally, it's very different. In the US, people just believe you, trust you, unless you prove to be an idiot. But I feel like in the UK, you got to watch your back all the time. It's a much harsher environment where people are judging you constantly. There's a lot of backbiting. You know, I have great relationships with the people, but the work environment I found difficult. I'd also just been promoted to a little bit more of a senior role. So it's like, oh, do I deserve this? I'd move from senior strategist to a client director, which was a very different function. And so I think part of it was also when you're in a new role, you're outside of your comfort zone. Somehow in the US, I could manage with my accent in those days. But, you know, the Brits have such an amazing way in which they speak. The command of the language, I feel, is outstanding. I just didn't have that same confidence. But luckily, we moved out of London in less than a year. I don't know how where my career would have gone if we, you know, decided to remain in London. But I came back to India and I had all of this experience, but I was also rooted in India and suddenly I started flying. Also, that was the time in which I got booted off a project. It was an Indian project. It was Jet Airways, actually. And it's also this weird thing that Indian clients didn't want an Indian person on the project. You know, but otherwise, you know, Enma, I've had 11 white male bosses in my company. Never, ever felt discriminated as a woman. In India, I would say some insecure moments because I was young. I was only 32 when I established Landor in India, country director initially. I was walking into boardrooms, presenting to Anand Mahindra, Mr. Tata, Adi Godrej. You know, sometimes I would have self-doubt, but the only way to overcome self-doubt is to do, you know, all the prep and more. When you are comfortable with the content, when you're doing what's right for the business, is something I learned from another leader recently, your confidence is huge. And so I, even in those days, I think I inherently knew it. I knew my stuff. And so that competence would shine through. And then it would be fine. But it was hard because in the Indian environment, actually it was a triple whammy. I was a woman, I was younger, I was also a bit Americanized. I think now I'm less so, but still I'm not Indian. I'm still more international. And so I think it can be seen as a double-edged sword.
Any stories, what happened and how you navigated it?
I mean, one, it's also my name. You know, I think in India, people want to always pinpoint you. So we're like Lulu Raghavan. Once I was in this boardroom, it was a very large company. It was a, you know, pre-chat before the meeting. And one of the senior directors said, "What is Lulu? Where does it even come from? What are you? Which part of India are you from?" In kind of an interrogation. I actually had to tell him, well, Lulu's not my real name. My real name is Sulakshana. That's my legal name. My mother gave me the name, named after Sulakshana Pandit. But my grandfather, a staunch Tamilian Brahmin from Madurai, somehow did not like the name. So he gave me the name Lulu. Sulu, Sulakshana, Sulu, Lulu. Mm-hmm. But people, Enma, think that I've bastardized my own name because, you know, Lulu sounds a bit, you know, nickname-y, Christian. It just throws people off balance is the right thing to say, because when I go in, I can see people trying to just check me out, be like, who is this Lulu Raghavan? And then when I say my background or my original name, Oh, Sulakshana is such a better name. Almost like beti up Sulakshana se hi, you Sulakshana na. It's just drives me nuts. And then some people would say Lulu G, which is also very funny, a bit patronizing, if you will. Another anecdote I would say is early on, the way you dress is very, very important. I was quite inspired by the ladies of the Taj who wear their saris so flawlessly, so beautifully. They carry it well. And Taj was one of my first clients in India. I spent a lot of time with them. And back to my mom, she took me out and she said, I'm buying you 5 saris. Start wearing saris. You've just come back to India. It's going to make a huge difference. And till today, if it's a big board meeting or I'm on a big panel discussion with ministers or, at a high level, I wear a sari and it's night and day. I can't tell you. Maybe it's just the way I look or I'm suited to saris. I even wear saris when I travel. So, these Delhi or Bangalore flights. I would say even in security, security ladies like, oh, madam, 5 baje aap sari pehenke kidhar ja rahi ho, bahut achhe lag rahe ho, and it gave me so much confidence in the early days that I could carry a sari well. And I feel that when you're wearing a sari, the respect and the way in which the client talks to you is between night and day. So I think that was one of the most valuable pieces of advice I got, and I use it very strategically, to be honest.
Did you have to adapt in any way when you went to the US, or were you too young and therefore you just sort of blended in very easily?
I did my undergrad in the US, so I'm very American in many ways. And so when I went back, no, it was fairly easy. It was Silicon Valley. I think I had to decide about the way I speak. So when I was in America, it was a little bit more American when I spoke. When I was in London, it was a bit more British, and my husband never liked that. He always says, like, why do you have a British accent? Or why are you more American? And even when I'm on a call, especially in COVID, my kids would be looking at me because my accent would suddenly change if I was speaking to my boss, who's British but is in Hong Kong. I feel from the way I speak perspective, I'm still adjusting. I don't think I've completely nailed it versus if I'm in Japan, Singapore, Australia, do I speak the way I'm speaking to you, which is a little bit more neutral, or to become a little bit more American? I have to work on it a little bit more.
Lulu, I heard a lot of times you saying that I am American in certain ways. Talk to me a little bit about that.
I think definitely from a perspective of work, the work ethic in the US is incredible, or rather too much, where it used to be pre-COVID. I know things have changed post-COVID, but the sincerity about work, the commitment to work, the desire to do really well, I think, is very American in me. My writing, critical thinking skills, I know the way that I would write comes a lot naturally to me, which I don't see my colleagues do as much. Those who haven't had an undergrad in the US, maybe now it's changing, when kids go to Ashoka and Flame and all of that. I think also Americans are just very friendly, especially in the business environment. You easily strike rapport. But then you also get down to work, email. A lot of it started in the US, right? Everything's on email. So email etiquette, how you build relationships on email. I read a lot of American authors, both from a business perspective and nonfiction. So yeah, I think in those kinds of ways, nothing political or, very much respecting every individual. Being very inclusive. Some of the best companies in the US are very, very progressive. Lando certainly is one of them, where everyone has a voice. You all feel like you belong. Diversity is super important. I mean, at our company now, 60% of leadership is female. That's maybe what I mean when I say American. I love Europeans. I lived in France and have lots of friends there. So nothing against the rest, but I think maybe because I spent so much time, almost 11 years between undergrad and work in the US, naturally, the way I operate, let's put it, is much American.
Yeah, like I relate more to Bombay than my hometown Chandigarh, because I think my, professional years and I really formed my own personality were in Mumbai or Bombay.
Exactly.
As a leader, what attributes are essential to be a part of your team?
First, I think hunger. Hunger to succeed, a desire to do really well is super important. Are you ambitious? That's definitely the first thing that I look for. Do you have energy? I like people who give energy, not drain energy. I hate energy vampires. I've been in rooms with many of them, and it's just really demotivating and depressing. How fast do you learn? Very important is your communication skills, both speaking and writing, how well you present yourself, how you can think, how well you write, because thinking and writing is very, very related. Empathy, and how likable are you? Will you get along? If they're going to work with me directly, I'll always think about, can I travel with this person? Will they be interesting? Or is it going to be a bit of, you know, drag to travel with them? I'm talking about things, Emma, which are above and beyond the hard skills. But I also really try to get a sense if this person that is interviewing really wants to be at Landor. Not just a job, but they know everything about Landor. They've done all of their homework. Most of the people who have gotten in here through cold calls or directly through me have made a very, very successful pitch about why Landor, not just brand consulting. And enough of times I've stopped an interview when I've asked them, what do you know about Landor? And there are senior people who say, actually, I don't know anything. And it's just so embarrassing. I was like, really sorry, but I think the interview is over right now. And then, of course, creative intelligence. At the end of the day, what we bring to our clients is creativity. So those are some of the key things I would look for.
With APAC, also under your leadership, how do you manage to accomplish so much? And this is keeping in mind that you're an early to bed and early to rise individual.
I do party when I travel because, you know, bonding with the teams, definitely that's when the schedule gets a little bit of a hit. But I think discipline has been one of the reasons for me being able to achieve what I have been able to. I feel it gives me a very, very good rhythm of my day. I'm a huge believer in the fact that the arc of your day becomes the arc of your life. So what you accomplish every day is what ultimately adds up. So if you want to write a book, start by writing 5 words a day or 5 pages a day. Whatever you want to do, you got to do a little bit every day. It is hard, Emma, because I travel a lot. And so the sleep does get impacted. But on a regular basis, I feel that the discipline gives me more energy. I work out every single day. Even today, even though I had to come early, I woke up at 5, I did a 6K run, I got ready, you know, asked my driver to come by 7:20 and showed up. That's what you need to do. And then I tried to be disciplined about saying no to things that may not be that necessary, especially with my new role. The biggest thing I've learned is saying no to things that I can't do, prioritizing on things that really matter to the company. So every day reminding myself, is this actually adding value or am I just wasting time clearing my inbox? What should I do today that's going to get the company ahead? What should I do to advance somebody who's stuck, who's waiting for my input to move ahead? So it's, I think, that triangulation in my head between what I have energy for, what's really required, and, you know, where I really need to focus.
They say it gets lonely as you go to the top. So do you first of all agree with that or do you think differently? And talk to me about mentors and role models in your journey.
It does get lonely to the top because people don't say exactly what they mean, you know, because everything is filtered through the lens of, oh, you're the boss. I've always had that because I've always been the boss the last 15 years. But now it's gotten even more so. I have to be more careful as well because I can't be buddy buddies with everybody because I have to make tough decisions. I wouldn't say it's lonely because my bosses have always been extremely friendly. I know tons of people within the Landor network. So I can always call up an MD or a VP of another region and troubleshoot. We have our backs. We also have WPP, so I'm very good friends with lots of the other agency leaders. Our country manager, Srini, is fantastic as a sounding board as well. So yes, it does get lonely in a few ways within your own organization in terms of the team. You can't necessarily have the same camaraderie with the team that I had, you know, maybe 5 years ago, but I have enough of people to call upon. So if I ever get lonely, it's just a phone call away. In terms of mentors, you know, I talk so much about mentorship, but to be honest, I never really had mentors other than all my bosses, all my 11 white male bosses, all, I think with the exception of one, really, really believed in me, pushed me ahead, saw where I needed to improve. I learned so much from each of them, whether it was delegation or being more curious, less judgmental, thinking bigger. My current boss is always about me thinking, 10 times bigger. Well, it's also because we want to scale APAC. And so that visionary thinking came from him. One of my earliest bosses from 2004, I still chat with him twice a year. And when I got the VP role, he was super happy. And he said, you just need to put the right people in the right roles across APAC and make sure that you have the right team to help you grow. So I still get advice from all of these people, including Alton, who hired me. I spoke to him last year after 21 years. Somehow we just hadn't spoken. I wanted to share with him, it couldn't have happened without him. Mm-hmm. And that he made that critical decision to save my job and not get me fired in that first week. I have had a few coaches along the way. I would say more professional coaches, not mentors. But I want to do a lot more of that now. I have access to so many incredible senior women. I just need to find time to do that. I think it'll be very critical now for my next stage of growth.
So which is the one thing you sort of added to your toolkit as you took on this larger role?
Which I didn't have before. I think I'd have to say being really fair. I have to be extra conscious because I make a lot of the decisions along with my boss across APAC, and I have to make sure that I'm not giving people from India more advantage because I know them and I know their skills. And every decision that we make, the transparency and the fairness around it, when we were small or when I was operating in India, it's easy to explain to people because I'm here, we talk. But when you're across APAC, you make decisions, people don't really understand why those decisions were made. So being very clear in the logic of decisions has been a journey. And then also just, I think I'm just driving more execution. Driving senior people is hard. With my team, everyone's younger than me. I can just crack the whip and everyone will listen. And they have to. But when you step outside of the realm that I'm comfortable with, a lot of senior people across, I've had to find a way to inspire them to do their best and give their best to the job without cracking the whip.
So did you do anything sort of intentional about then building that rapport?
Yeah, when I visited all of the markets, spending the time and the energy to build individual relationships, I think is very, very important. So that rapport then helps you to deliver harder messages, to say that, hey, you're capable of a lot and your expectations are high. It all comes from that rapport building. So I would say I need to do more of that.
So given that your mom told you, Lulu, now slow down and focus on your home, how do you strike that balance?
Very tough. I have two teenage girls who are 16 and 15. But Enma, the funniest story is, 10 years ago, I would feel very guilty about not being there for them when the bus came home. And so once when I was having one of these low periods, I said to them, Ruhi and Reva, I think I'm going to quit Landor. I want to be there for you when the bus comes. I want to give you your snack at 4 o'clock and help you with your homework. They were horrified. They were like, no, mom, please don't do that. You love Landor too much. Landor loves you. And we love Landor. So no, you shouldn't do that. They were only about, I would say 10 or 12 then. And that showed me that while I've had to sacrifice some of the things I would have done for them because of my job or not being there sometimes, I think at the end of it, they're incredibly proud. All of their friends know me. And I had the opportunity last year to do a TEDx at their school, which also then, allowed their staff, the faculty and their friends to see me, etc. So I thought they'll hug me and say, when are you quitting? And they're like, no way. And so after that, I've used it as a threat a few times. Like, you guys are not studying. I think I need to quit Landor now and supervise. And so then they were like, no, please don't do that.
Awesome. Thank you, Lulu. This has been so lovely. I really wish I could keep talking, but...
Oh, no. Thank you so much. You've asked such good questions. It's made me reflect. And you know, look forward to staying in touch with you.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.